Welcome. Welcome to Recipe for Peace Now. I'm your host, Sue Beller, and this is the show where we find practical, real-life solutions to difficulties bringing people together for a common goal, a common good. We will discuss listener emails, answer common questions, and at the end of the show, we'll have two delicious potluck recipes made for sharing with your new community of, well, if not exactly friends, at least willing participants. If you would like to send in a question or a favorite recipe, please email us at recipeforpeacenow@gmail.com or visit our website at www.recipeforpeacenow.com. Also, welcome back to our regular listeners. Welcome to those of you who are new. The last five radio broadcasts are indeed archived on our website. The rest of them are archived at the radio station, which is www.blogtalkradio.com/recipeforpeacenow. Thanks. I hope to hear from you. Okay, let's get started. Now, this week, our topic is going to be how to motivate people to participate, how to get people to not just sit there, to not just come and take up space, but to actually get them to participate in trying to reach a chord, trying to get a common goal, trying to forge forward down the path. You see, sometimes, and I'm sure that we've all had this, and I see, thank you everyone for participating. I see we already have lots of participants. Hello, good morning to you. And I know that a lot of us have had this, where someone has been rather forced to come in body, if physically they're sitting there, but they really didn't come to participate in a positive manner. They came to, well, to just take up space. And we've already had a show about those of them that come to be, how shall I put this delicately, come to be disruptive, haven't we? We've discussed that. And, of course, that show is archived. We'll discuss it a smidge now because I see that a lot of people are already talking about that. Thank you very much for your participation. In fact, we have a lot of agreement that people come to a community gathering, come to a meeting, come to a mediation with the intent not to participate. And we have to motivate those people. We have to get everyone to participate because if they don't, we will not reach a satisfactory conclusion that encompasses all parties. And that, of course, is our goal. That's what we would like, wouldn't we? Yes, of course. And, we've got some examples here of what we're talking about. Kevin, for example, says that he had a participant who ate huge amounts of food and then left without a word. Yes. You know, some years ago, I had a person who was a participant in one of my gatherings who actually announced that he had come just for the food and was not intending to participate in any way, shape, or form, except he came for dinner. And you know what? When somebody does that, you have... Oh, I see already people making suggestions. Yes, and some of them are very good. We have Aishu who says that she's actually doesn't put the food out. Quite a few of you are saying that you don't put the food out in the room first. You know, that is an idea. Oftentimes we'll keep dishes covered and not really have them out. Well, if they're warm and you have no place to put them, you have to put them out somewhere. But if you keep them covered, they're not really accessible yet. A good way of doing that also to keep something from being accessed too early in the program is to not put the utensils out, not put the plates and the napkins and utensils, the serving utensils, for example, out until we're ready to take a break and have a nice convivial atmosphere. And it is true, I see quite a few of you, thank you, this is wonderful, I see quite a few of you who have actually been to one of our seminars, one of our workshops, and it is a true statement that because, and you've heard me say this before, because I think that the host should indeed have plenty, and it makes a convivial atmosphere if people can munch on something. I do indeed, this is true, I do indeed have beverages out, right, when you come in. I'm getting some questions about alcoholic beverages. I am not adverse, and I see a lot of you might be, to serving wine if it is, or beer, if it is not against the religious precepts of one of the parties, unless there's a prohibition against it. I do not serve anything stronger. I think that will cause perhaps an adverse effect, you see. And you don't want people to become sloppy or lose focus. Or sometimes people become more easily angered by someone saying something that doesn't agree with them specifically, you see, if they get a little bit inebriated. So, no, I do not serve hard liquor. I will serve wine if it is not prohibited. I don't serve lots. A glass will pretty much do it, then people need to hold on to it. I do indeed have juice and sodas and things like that. And yes, it is true that I have snack in the room, bowls of snack all over the place, but I don't put out the food as you come in the door because this is not really a dining experience, as Kevin had, where somebody came in, ate, and left. That's not the idea. We're going to, I see several people have said that. Isha says that you have to work for your food. And I suppose that's true, really. We're going to have to do some introductions. We're going to have to do some passing around of information. We're going to have to do some discussion. And when we have gotten to a point where we need a break, then we will start having our supper. We will start having our treat, so to speak. And yes, I see that I've gotten that Aisha has quite a bit of agreement that it is kind of like, well, you want to eat, you got to work some first. But I think snack is not eating. And people are asking what I mean by snack. I see quite a few of those questions. And the answer is, I truly mean snack. I usually have bowls of something dry out that doesn't make too big of a mess. In this show, we do not promote any kind of a product because it would not be a proper thing to do. But I will tell you that I am fond of the Chex Mix type concept where you take the cereal and you bake it a little bit with some tastes and put some pretzels and things in with it. Real mix, so to speak, that is pleasant to eat. And later on in the show, those of you who know me and have listened before know that I'm going to say that if you're going to create a Chex Mix type object where you're going to put some Tabasco and things like that perhaps in it, it does need to be labeled so that people do not accidentally eat something that they are prohibited by diet, by religion, or by allergy. You don't want anybody getting sick, and you don't want them to get offended. And we'll talk a little bit more about that when we talk about our recipes. But it is true even of the mix. If it's not obvious, like a bag of pretzels, and I would truly think that you shouldn't put out anything that isn't obvious and that is common to be allergic to. You see, peanuts is an awful big offender. I don't usually put those out. But in any event, yes. So that's a way to prevent people from just coming to eat because that's not our idea. And I have several people that say that if you have somebody... The question has been asked, if somebody is making a mess with the food? Because, you know, that happens sometimes. And I would say the answer is, it depends if it is deliberate. Even if it's deliberate or not deliberate, oftentimes I think it's good, excuse me, to offer to help the person. You see? And then they can't say, no, I'd really like, I'm deliberately making a mess and I don't want your help. You see, so you offer to help them in a gracious manner. And, yes, several people, in answer to the question about making a mess, and also to the question about what happens when people just kind of come to eat and not to contribute, several people have said this, and it's a real good idea. I don't usually do this because I haven't had the problem of non-participation in quite a while. And, well, okay, people are saying that you pass one dish at a time around the room, and you ask so that all the food isn't out at one time, and you take it and you pass it around. I tend not to do that for the simple reason that it gets a little messy just by itself, and you have to judge the people in your group. Yes, I know people are already writing in the two words that I've been rightfully accused of saying constantly on this show, and I'm going to say it again. I'm going to say it depends. Yes, everybody's writing it depends in response to that, because yes, I know I say that a lot, but it does. It depends on your group. If your group is the kind of a group that family style, passing around the bowls will be convivial and good and everybody can physically handle it and nobody will feel left out and they can all, you know, take what they want, yes, that might be a wonderful thing to do. And it is a way to control the movement of the food, the assumption being, of course, that after it's been passed to everybody, the whatever is left gets poured out, right? Right. And, of course, we're going to have lots, so there's going to be some left. And, it's a real good idea to pass it around. I don't usually, because I think there's more of a potential for accidentally dropping something. But it's a, depending on your group, it's a very nice convivial idea. Now, I see several people, Brian in particular, seems to have had this several times. Thank you, by the way, for participating. I love hearing from you. And thank you to the people that have been here before, and thank you to all the new ones, too. Yes, I always learn something from this show, and I hope that you all learn something, too. So we have several people that are talking about people that not only don't come to participate, but they come to disrupt the orderly process of reaching accord, of reaching agreement. They come to be disruptive. They're not just passively, I won't. They are aggressively, I'm going to disrupt. Brian says that he had somebody brought a baby, which was inappropriate to the group and to the situation and like that. And yes, I know that some of you advocate doing this, and I don't generally advocate it, but you know my theory that if you have to, you have to, and if it works, it works. Several people have said that when someone does a thing like that, that you should ask them to leave, that you should throw them out of the process, and then they won't do it again. I tend to try to be more conciliatory if I can. If the baby is not disruptive, if the child is sleeping, for example, maybe. I would personally like to wait until the disruption occurs, you see, and not just do it out of hand. Let's see. Brian says, oh my, Brian says that he once had someone to one of these community gatherings bring an I see several people that say people have brought an animal, like a dog. Of course, a service animal doesn't count. A service animal is, of course, something that you have to have, and they're usually extremely well-behaved and used to groups. But Brian says that he actually had someone bring a pot-bellied pig to a group where people thought that pigs were an unclean animal, just by their religious preference. Yes, I'm going to agree with all of you that say, make them leave. But it depends. Yes, because you are the host. You are the impartial third party. And it depends if the reason for the disruptive act, which we will assume that if someone brings an unusual pet like that, and I know potbelly pigs are little pets and they were popular a while back, but that's an unusual pet. And if they bring an animal that is prohibited by the other people's religious beliefs and like that, well, yes, I'm seeing a lot of people saying that they weren't going to eat the pig, which is true. That's true, they weren't going to have a barbecue and eat the pig. But still, I mean, that's a step beyond bringing the doggy. But if the participant who does this is very important to the process, is really, for example, a leader or somebody that you need to have involved, and they have brought the animal or the disruption as a test, so to speak, for example, a test of your resolve and your experience as host, let's think about that for a moment. We do not wish to throw them out because they need to be there and they need to participate. Well, what should we do? Now, I have some people that are saying you should ignore it and just keep going and just pretend that it's not a disruption. That's an idea. It depends how much of a disruption you've got going. I usually, and it is true that I usually have the luxury of having a staff member or a office person or an intern or some responsible human being in the area when I'm doing one of these. I will get that responsible human being, the outsider, to take the disruption into the other room and be nice to him, her, or it. I mean, depending on if it's a little kid or an animal or something. Usually they can be fed and entertained and like that in the next room, you see, by a responsible adult type person. So that would be my preference to do that. It might be, I see the people are saying that you could ask the person to find someone to find a caregiver. And come right back. That's kind of a temporary go away and come back type thing. And we will hold the, well, you see, if you hold the process, then that's a power play, right? Right, because they made a disruption, which was truly a disruption, because you had to hold the process. You see? The answer is that if you need to keep the person and they have brought a disruptive creature, a disruptive something or someone, that perhaps they can be separated for a short period of time, enough for the meeting, and then reunited. You see? That's the idea of the thing. So that you can get the participation without having to stop and say, well, we'll have to do it another night, not having to stop and say, you know, you can't do that. It's kind of a delicate tap dance. I see that several people, I think it might somewhat depend on where you are in the world. You know, this show is, of course, global, and I'm very pleased that all of you are here. And it makes for an interesting discussion, an interesting group, because some people are saying that animals and children are not a disruption. They are just a natural part of the process and a natural part of family, and it makes for a convivial atmosphere. And that is absolutely true if that is what is happening. If that's just a convivial atmosphere, you're in somebody's home, their children are there, their animals are there, and like that. And it's not a distraction, and it adds to the conviviality, go for it. That's a wonderful thing. And whatever works is good. And, yes, if that's, I see quite a bit of agreement that children are an asset and they'd like to come to see the potluck and the people. And they, Gary says that children and family are the reason why we're trying to reach accord, which is a very good point. And if it is not a distraction, I did not mean to imply that children and pets and animals and like that were always a distraction. In fact, they can be a wonderful convivial addition if we all go and talk about them or see them or interact in some way. So, yes, it doesn't necessarily have to be a distraction. But if it is, we will handle it graciously at the time. Okay, now, we've talked about people that come and don't want to participate in kind of a negative manner. But I was really thinking more of how to create willingness to participate, which is more than just not being disruptive. Willingness to participate is also not being just passive, just sitting there, just coming in body but not in spirit. And I was thinking more of speaking of ways to engage the participants in the group. You see, and that's really what we want to do. Most people do not come to be disruptive, but some people are very shy. And some people are reticent to speak in front of a group. Some people don't like to give an opinion because they're afraid that that won't be the majority when it all shakes out. And like that for a variety of reasons. And you want these people, we want everyone to participate towards reaching the common goal, because that's how it's going to be a good outcome. That's how it's going to be something that we can all follow, that we're going to all want. So how can we do that? Pardon me. How can we get participants to really want to join in? You know, I think, we have lots of comments here. That's wonderful. Thank you very, very much for all of your participation. And people are saying that creating the convivial atmosphere, the idea of Recipe for Peace Now, to create a convivial atmosphere in which to conduct business is one of the ways that you get people to participate. And yes, that is, of course, the secret recipe, so to speak. That is why we advocate having a potluck, getting together, having more of a convivial networking, getting to know each other, and then getting down to what is between us, because it will make for a more successful and more long-lasting solution. You see, sometimes the leaders can say what they want, but the followers won't follow. And that's not what we had in mind. So I think, and I see that I have a lot of agreement here, that the first thing to do is that we, as hosts and as third-party mediators and as participants, should set a good example. Yes, I think we should be good examples. I think, for example, that we should be prepared. You know, I do a lot of these, and I see all kinds of different disputes, all kinds of conflicts, all kinds of facts in contention and laws that need to be changed and like that. And the main preparation is very important. And you certainly don't want to lose track of which group this is. Well, if you do enough of them, sometimes that might happen. So I think it's very important to bring your laptop and have the information in a file very clearly prepared. and that you should have in your hand any exhibits, any physical things that we're going to talk about, any papers, any documents. Sometimes what we're talking about is, for example, a mock-up, a model or something. It might actually be three-dimensional. But it's important to have all of your information in front of you and to be truly prepared so that you don't, you know if something that is being argued is simply not right concerning the facts, or whether or not, yes, I see a lot of you have caught me there. Sometimes the facts need to be discussed and revised because we might not be in complete agreement as to what is an actual fact. Isn't that something? That's a fundamental thing we're going to have to discuss, a fundamental accord that we're going to have to reach. And now what does that mean? That means that as good examples, we are going to act reasonably, aren't we? Yes, we're going to be reasonable. We're going to act like sensible human beings and not just argue or bicker or go around in circles. We want to show that we're going to be reasonable and that we're going to stay on track and push forward, you see, so that we can all get to where we're going, reach agreement, and go on. It's a very good thing, yes. So we're going to be reasonable. Yes, and I see quite a few of you, Gary and Lane and Diane, quite a few of you have said that you need to be polite as a good example. Basically speaking, polite. Yes, you need to be gracious. You need to be polite. You need to treat everyone in a polite and gracious manner. If you, as the host, do not act in a gracious and polite manner towards everyone, they will not get the cue from you, and they will not act graciously and politely, not only not to you, but to each other. You're going to have a nasty session. And there's no need for that. We can all be gracious and polite. And that is contagious. Just like I always say that bad behavior is contagious, good behavior is contagious too. It's rather like peer pressure. You see, everybody goes, well, no one else is using bad language or shouting or blaming someone else. I don't think I'm supposed to do it too. I'd be kind of what? Yes, a lot of people have filled in the blank. Thank you. You'd be kind of embarrassed, ashamed to be nasty and vitriolic and aggressive, you see? Because everyone's being gracious and polite. Yes. Yes, I know it's a cultural and social moray. People have said that's kind of a falseness. But no, that's just a pleasant way of dealing, I think. And I think it also, and I see that a lot of people have mentioned the actual physical setting, if I have read these correctly, that it's the responsibility of the host to have a safe environment within a comfortable setting, according to Gary and Abigail and like that. Yes, thank you very much for your comments. A responsibility to have a safe environment with a comfortable setting. I think that's true. How about being certain that there is a chair for everyone? Everybody has a place to sit. Because otherwise, the people that have to stand are like second-class citizens, aren't they? Because they don't have the luxury of a seat. Now, some people will choose to stand and perhaps kind of wander around the room a smidge and look in the snack department and like that. Some people like to think while moving a smidge, but they should have a seat, even if they don't particularly care to always sit in it. But everybody needs to have a comfortable place to sit. Yes. And that leads you to think about how many people your venue can hold, right? We want to make a comfortable setting and a safe environment. Yes. I see. Well, several people have said that they meant safe environment in more of a literal way than I took it. And they meant, if you're going, for example, I see that several people, thank you very much for your participation. I see Henry and Gary and Lane and several others are dealing with neighborhood disputes that have to do with some violence, like, for example, gang violence. And you need to have a literally safe and neutral setting so that no one does something violent right in the room there. Oh, I see that the people that deal with gang-related neighborhood issues, actually, several of you are telling me that you actually, it's a leave weapons at the door type thing, that you do not permit gang colors and that you do not permit weapons to be brought in. And, oh my, Gary actually uses a metal scanner, a handheld metal scanner. So, you know, this comes under my category, and I know that I say this a lot, too, but it comes under, yes, people are writing, it depends. Yes, it depends. It comes under the it depends category, because if that's what you need to do to keep your participants safe and to create a welcoming environment and to create a convivial atmosphere, then that's what you need to do. And if that's the group that you're dealing with, well, you need to be a realist and you need to acknowledge that. And yes, that's what you need to do. So that depends on your group. I don't generally do groups that need to be searched, but if you do, go for it. And yes, we have discussed this before. Several people are, generally speaking, have a community gathering that they feel needs to have a, in order to make a gracious and comfortable setting where everybody is comfortable and feels safe, they actually hire an off-duty police officer or a security guard to be present at the meeting. And, pardon me, if that's what you need to do, that's what you need to do. I don't, it's not something, you have to determine that depending on what group. Okay, now here's a comment that I've been seeing quite a bit, and Harriet and Charles and several people have said the same thing, basically speaking. I'm going to paraphrase it, that it's in order to set a good example so the participants will participate, that you need not to complain about all the work that you're doing. And that's a real good point. If you complain about it, then people are going to say, well, she's in charge. If she's complaining about it, it must be a lot of work. And if I complain about it, I won't have to do it. You see, that's not good participation. You want them to, how about we're going to delegate some responsibility to our participants? How about some research? How about some outreach? How about a survey? You know, how about an internet research? Whatever it is that will cause your participants to think about the issues and think about them all week long, right? Say that we're having a meeting every couple of weeks, which would not be unreasonable, since we want to resolve the issues fairly promptly. We might even have a meeting more frequently. We might meet every week or whenever we need to. And you want your participants not only to participate verbally when they come, but you want them to have thought about it, thought about the issues, thought about compromise. Can we say compromise is a very good thing to think about? Thought about compromise when they're not sitting in the room, during the week, so to speak, when during their off time, they think they need to think about it. And they need to say, well, what am I going to do in order to have a compromise, in order to reach an agreement? And what kind of research will I need to bring the next time to convince others of my side, of the truth of what I am saying? You see? And that's real participation. How about we get together over emails? We share information. That's during when we're not there, when we're not looking at each other. You see, although during this show, we oftentimes, in fact, we usually discuss face-to-face get-togethers, where we're actually having food and we're actually working on something face-to-face. But that's really not necessarily true, is it? We can still be participating non-face-to-face. We can be participating emails, phone calls. I especially like to have an email that goes reply all, right? I know that some of us get in trouble when we do reply all in the business context, but reply all means that everybody gets to see it, everybody gets to think about it, and everybody gets to participate, not only when they're sitting there, but also think about it and come prepared the next time. Because, yes, and I'm getting that people are asking if participation is the same as being prepared. It kind of is, isn't it? Because participation is being able to say something intelligent and noteworthy during the gathering. Being able to bring something of use to the table. Participation means that you've really thought on it and you've really researched something and you want to persuade others to come a little closer to your side so we can all meet in the middle. Yes, very important to get everyone to participate. Now, thank you very much. And one of the things we participate in, isn't it, is we're going to participate in the whole event. And not just in the eating part, right? Yes, we're going to participate in the convivial atmosphere. We're going to participate in the issues that concern us. And we're going to have everybody's participation so that when it comes down to making an agreement, everyone will say, I helped with this. I participated. I think it is a good result. And they will go back to their followers and they will give this as a pronouncement and they will be able to reason it out because people want to know how come you made some sort of a compromise, right? Right. And they will be able to show that this was a reasonable and a win situation for their side. Because we've discussed this before, and when you have a mediation, when you have a community get-together, when you have a meeting, an event, a seminar, a workshop, whatever it is that you're doing, the idea, of course, is for everyone to, when agreement is reached, to feel that their side has been fairly treated, and that they have won some, that they have been successful, because then the agreement will truly be implemented and will not be something that just is in words, and we've all seen those, but not in practice. So, we have now come to, I think, some people's favorite portion of the show. We've come to the food part, because I have promised two lovely recipes for sharing. And we usually think of these in a sharing context, because, generally speaking, we're holding some sort of a potluck, right? Right. And I don't usually give portions, because people take a spoonful, and it depends how many other items there are and how many people you have. If you need to double them, double them. It's good, and most of these can pretty much be refrigerated overnight one time. So you can feed your family too. So now, and people are already writing in. Thank you. It's very wonderful to have lots of loyal listeners, and they're writing the word label. Because for those of you who are fairly new, you know that when we get to this portion of the show, I always say the same thing. I say that if you're going to bring food and you're going to ask people to do so, first of all, you need to ask if anyone has a severe allergy or a serious prohibition over a type of food. And you must ask everyone to label what is in the food, so that no one gets an ugly surprise, so that no one has an allergic reaction, no one accidentally eats something that is prohibited by their dietary needs or by their religious prohibitions. You don't want to make anybody sick or panicky, or it's supposed to be a lovely get-together in order to reach common ground type event. And we certainly don't want to have any accidents. So we're not going to cheat on the labeling. And we're going to put everything that's in there. And then everybody will know what it is. Now, I usually have a safe recipe and an adventure recipe. And I consider my safe recipe something that does not have a tremendous amount of ingredients. And most of the ingredients show. You can pretty much see what you've got. So when you look at it, you go, well, I'll read the label anyway, but I believe I know what this is. So the safe recipe today, I'm actually going to do two pastas because they are so different from one another, and I thought it would be fun to consider both of them. So the safe recipe is going to be a spinach fettuccine with ham. And yes, we are going to use spinach fettuccine, if you can find it, the green stuff, as they say, because it is beautiful, it's pretty, and it adds some spinach taste and aroma to this. So if you can find it, if not, use regular fettuccine. So we're going to do 1.5 pounds of the fettuccine, which, of course, we're going to boil al dente, and then drain really well. And we're going to have 2 tablespoons of olive oil. We're going to have 8 slices, that's kind of thin slices of ham, which we're going to chop up. And yes, I see people already telling me that prosciutto would be preferable. It is also, that's fancy ham, of course. It would undoubtedly be preferable, this is true. And it is substantially more expensive. So I don't know that it's warranted in a dish like this because we're going for the taste and the saltiness. So you can decide. But I usually use ham. Oh, I confess, oftentimes, it's supposed to be with ham kind of traditionally, oftentimes I will substitute bacon for the ham. And that's rather yummy, too, I got to tell you. It's nice and salty and delicious and crispy. So you use either ham or prosciutto, which is, of course, ham that's kind of nicer, or bacon. And just chop the ham, the prosciutto, and basically rough chop the bacon. And, yes, it's very nice. I said 8 thin slices of ham. How much bacon? About 10 slices, I would say. It's up to you how much you like in there. 10, 12, yeah, whatever. Depends how thick your bacon is, too. Okay, so we've got the pasta, which we've cooked al dente. We've got the 2 tablespoons of olive oil. We've got the ham or the prosciutto or the bacon. And we're going to have 3 scallions that we're going to chop up. And we're going to have a big bunch of spinach. Fresh spinach is very nice in this. Yes, I have been known to use frozen that's thawed very carefully. You know, you thaw it in the refrigerator or on the sink or whatever. Fresh is always better. Thawed is not bad at all, and it is a lot easier. You know that if you're going to use a bunch of spinach, you need to wash it very carefully. If it's coming from like a farmer's market, if it's coming from one of those bags, I think they're pre-washed. But anyway, use either fresh spinach or frozen spinach. Of course, you thaw the frozen spinach, right? Right. We've got a couple of tablespoons of balsamic vinegar. Yum. Make it just delicious. I actually add a little bit of sugar when I use the balsamic vinegar to just kind of even it out. And yes, I know everybody thinks that my taste is rather sweet in that sense, but I think it kind of evens it out. So I'm going to say 2 tablespoons of balsamic vinegar and like a teaspoon of that very fine, that super fine sugar. So we've got the pasta already boiled and drained. And now we're going to heat the oil in a large fry pan, a large deep pan. And we're going to add the ham, and we're going to add the scallions, and we're going to cook that, and then we're going to stir it occasionally over medium heat until the ham or whatever you've got gets nice and crisp. Then we're going to chop the spinach. If it's fresh, of course, we're going to trim the stalks, yes, depending on if you have stalks. But we're going to chop the spinach leaves, and we're going to stir in the vinegar and the sugar into the pan with the ham and the scallions and the oil. And we're going to cover it and we're going to cook it for about a minute until the spinach is really incorporated. Now, if you're using fresh, it needs to soften. If you're using what was frozen, it needs to be hot, of course, until everything is nicely incorporated. We've thrown all of our ingredients in and we're now going to cook it and cover it and get the whole thing nice and hot and soft. And then we're going to take it and we're going to put it over our pasta and we're going to mix the whole thing together. Yum! And it's easy and it's pretty and everybody likes it. And it doesn't have too many unusual ingredients to it. So it's not much of a surprise. So that's my safe recipe for this today. For this show, because it's kind of, you can see what's in it, and most people are not allergic. Of course, yes, a lot of people are mentioning this, that ham, bacon, prosciutto like that is pork, of course. And you have to know that people do not have a prohibition against eating pork. But of course it is labeled and you can see it. Yes, yes. Okay, now we're going to go for our adventure recipe because it is a little bit unusual. And this is a lovely recipe that I got from our friend Layla. And honestly, I want to invite her to all of my potlucks because it's just so delicious. And it sounds kind of odd because it's a baked spaghetti with lamb in a custard sauce. Yes, look, it's a pasta dish that's not that much harder to make, but is rather unusual. And it's very interesting and very delicious, and everybody enjoys it greatly. So we're going to start. I'm going to have 2 separate parts of this recipe. One is the main part of it, and one is the sauce. So we're going to go for the main part first. We're going to take 1.5, maybe closer to 2 pounds of spaghetti, and we're going to cook it and drain it, just regular spaghetti. And we're going to have about 1/2 cup of pine nuts. Yes, people are saying that Yes, pine nuts are indeed very expensive. And oh, hard to come by, depending on where you live and what kind of store you have access to. I have personally used slivered almonds instead of the pine nuts. Is it the same? Well, no. Is it very nice? Yeah, it's delicious. It's very nice. It looks pretty, and slivered almonds are a lot cheaper, and most people aren't allergic to almonds, and they're easier to come by. And yes, you can use some coarse chopped nuts of other sorts too. People are asking about all kinds of different nuts. Yeah, I don't know why. I would think that you could use walnuts and anything that you find that's kind of coarsely chopped would be lovely. The idea is kind of the size of the pine nuts. And the almonds look more like pine nuts, but any kind of a coarse chopped nut will be just fine. Don't use peanuts or something that has a lot of skin to it, I think. But you can use your judgment. A lot of people are allergic to peanuts. We've got 2 tablespoons of butter. Because we're going to divide that up, we're going to grease a pan with it. We're going to have 1.5 pounds of ground. Now, I like lamb, ground lamb. You can use, if you don't have ground lamb, you can certainly use ground beef. I like ground pork. And yes, thank you very much for your participation. Lots of you always say, can you use ground turkey? I don't see why not. Yes, use ground turkey because we're going to brown it and season it. And I just usually use the more distinctly tasty type of meats, like the lamb or the pork, but certainly do so. Ground turkey, I'm sure, would be just fine. I just don't happen to usually use it. And we're going to have about a quarter of a teaspoon of cinnamon, the real cinnamon, the kind that is ground cinnamon. A quarter of a teaspoon of allspice, the ground allspice, and we're going to use salt and pepper, depending on how much we like. So that's the body of it. And while we're getting that together, we're going to preheat our oven to 350. Did I say that? I don't think I did. So we're going to preheat the oven to 350. That's the body of it. We're going to get all of those things together. Now, in a separate category, we're going to do the custard sauce. We're going to have 2 eggs that we're going to beat real thoroughly, 4 cups of whole milk, and a tablespoon of cornstarch. Okey-dokey. Now, we, of course, are going to cook and drain the spaghetti. Right. And we're going to take the nuts, whatever nuts we've got, and I'm going to say pine nuts because they are the most delicious and the prettiest in it. But they're kind of a sweet nut. We all know what pine nuts are. Yes. I'm getting a few questions about it. They are a small, sweet, light-colored nut, which is why I picked almonds as their substitute. And we're going to brown the nuts in 1 tablespoon of butter. We're going to add the meat and the seasonings right in the same pan, and we're going to continue sautéing it until everything's brown. We're going to brown the meat and the nuts and the seasonings and like that within this pan with a little bit of butter. And we're also going to take a 9 by 13 inch pan, one of those rectangular pans, and we're going to butter that real thoroughly around with the other tablespoon of butter. You see, we've sautéed, we've browned in some butter, and we're going to grease the pan with the rest of the butter. So we're going to take our spaghetti, and we're going to place about half of it on the bottom of the pan that's now been greased. We're going to now layer the meat mixture on the top of the spaghetti that we've just placed in the bottom of the pan, and we're going to take the other half of the spaghetti, and we're going to put it on top. So what we've made is a meat sandwich, right? We've got spaghetti, meat mixture with all the seasonings and the browned meat, or the browned, whatever it is you're using, the pork, the lamb, the browned turkey breast, the ground meat, and then we're going to layer another layer of spaghetti over it. Now, we're going to do the sauce. you're going to take your two eggs that have already beaten, your milk, and your cornstarch, and you're going to mix them all together with a little whisk, real, real hard so that they're not lumpy. Because, you know, that cornstarch, you got to kind of put it in gradually as you're whisking it, and you don't want any lumps. Now, you've got this lovely custard sauce. You're going to evenly pour it over the whole spaghetti mixture, just over the top, just up and back. And you're going to bake it in that preheated 350-degree oven for about 40 minutes until the whole thing sets. And it will be surprisingly, well, not going to be surprised, because you can see how delicious that's going to be. But look what a different kind of a dish that is than the last one, which was also a pasta dish. So we're going to have this pan with this lovely pasta and meat mixture in kind of a custard sauce. Yes, delicious. So we're going to bake it until the whole thing sets. And then when you take it out of the oven, and you might even bake it ahead of time and then bring it and then reheat it a little, be sure, of course, you all know that if you're going to bake it a lot ahead, not to just leave it out and let it get kind of crummy. You need to refrigerate, of course. But if you're taking it straight out of the oven and you need it to set, let it sit on the stove or on a hot mat for about 15 minutes, or 10, 15 minutes before you cut into it. It will firm the whole thing up. Once you take it out of the oven, don't cut into it instantly. Give it a minute to kind of firm up and set, as they say. Yes. So that's our two recipes. And that's my adventure recipe because it has a little bit more adventurous spices. It's got the allspice and the cinnamon. And it's less obvious what's in it, and it's slightly more unusual as a recipe. We're going to, of course, label it. And it will be very popular, and people will really, really want to know how you made that, is what it really is. No, it will. Both of them are very good for potluck, because you can take as little or as much as you would like. So, we've come to the end of this show. My goodness, they go so fast. I hope you have learned something. I have learned something, too. I always do. Thank you for all of your participation. Thank you for listening. If you would like to contact us, we're at recipeforpeacenow@gmail.com. The website is www.recipeforpeacenow.com. All of the shows are archived on the radio station at www.blogtalkradio.com/recipeforpeacenow. And I'd like to thank all of you for coming. I hope that you come again. And thank you very much. Bye-bye.